Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, award-winning writers Asali Solomon and Rebecca Mackay discuss Solomon's new novel, The Days of Afrikiti. This conversation originally took place October 26th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you all for your support of the past, present, and future of American writing. In The Days of Afrikiti, Asali Solomon examines the lives of two women living a single day, considering their choices and the directions they took from a common starting point. The book grapples with the way we reimagine ourselves and reassess the people we've allowed to change us. Asali Solomon's first novel, Disgruntled, was the best book of the year, the San Francisco Chronicle and the Denver Post. Her first book, Get Down, earned her a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honor, and was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. Her work has appeared in O, The Oprah Magazine, Vibe, Essence, The Paris Reviews, The Daily, McSweeney's, and several anthologies, and on NPR. She teaches fiction writing and literature of the African diaspora at Haverford College. She's joined tonight by Rebecca Mackay, Artistic Director of Story Studios Chicago, and author of the novels The Great Believers, The Hundred Year House, and The Borrower, as well as the short story collection Music for Wartime. I'm going to welcome them back into the room. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
Right. So I am so thrilled to be talking about this book with you. I devoured this. And I have to say, like, I am, my mind is, like everyone, I'm having a hard time sometimes focusing on narratives that don't grab me right away. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to resort to like reading a political thriller or something, but I want the literature that's going to be repulsive. And, you know, this is a book about one day. It's not a book about like people jumping out of airplanes or anything. And I couldn't put it down. I was so excited to find something that I was like taking with me, you know, like I had it in the car at one point, like reading it in the carpool lane. So
I'm not safe.
I was stopped in the park carpool. I'm 5 minutes early. I don't want to get out and talk to other people right now. I'm just here to read this. But congratulations on beautiful novel and on the great reviews that it's been getting. And it's been a week now out in the world. This isn't a question. I'm just going to say, I predict that this is going to be a major breakout is what I'm trying to say for you, in terms of public response, because I think it's getting people talking already in a very exciting way. So we'll see. I would love to start by asking you, and I know you're going to read to us maybe in a minute or two. But before we do that, this is a book that is very much in conversation with other books. And, you know, I was grateful actually for the back of my advanced copy that I don't know if the finished copy does the same thing, that really calls out both Mrs. Dalloway and Sula, by Virginia Woolf and Toni Morrison, respectively. I'd like to think that I would have gotten the references, but I'm not entirely sure. And my reading was definitely enriched by thinking of those. And then of course, the title Days of Afrikiti, that's based on an Audre Lorde character who's being referenced in the book. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about, I want to call it the anxiety of influence, but you might not have been anxious at all and you shouldn't have been anxious. Can we talk about that influence on the work and what it meant to be in conversation with those big, big voices in this really, you know, a very serious way?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say the anxiety of influence, because I think definitely, you know, one could think, you know, I'm it's really about me sort of, in a way, like geeking out with these other books, right? Yeah. And like, just trying to, you know, think about the way that once you read certain books, they become a part of your life and you start to feel like you're just like the characters are people in your lives, or like they lodge themselves into your body or something like that. And so, and I just think, you know, I have a PhD, and so I really immersed myself in literature in a particular kind of way before I really started seriously writing. And so I think that, like, I didn't really think of this as myself as saying, like, oh, this is just like Mrs. Dalloway, or this is the company I'm so, but more like, this is, you know, this is like being a fan, you know, in a certain kind of way, but in a more interesting way than just simply saying, I like that, you know, but actually trying to become a part of the world of those books in a way is like something that like makes me feel inspired imagination wise.
It makes sense. I mean, I think, you know, most closely in structure, it's following Mrs. Dalloway.
I mean, that's completely explicit. And that's actually how the book came about. And I don't know why. And I don't know why I started thinking about that. But I just sort of, when I was thinking about writing another novel, I started thinking about the structure and how it was such a, like, you know, it could do so much. It could do so much in terms of having a front story that kept moving and like emotional background.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're also, I mean, something that Wolf did very, very well was to depict human consciousness on the page in a way that at that point, you know, we were just starting to realize how we could represent the limitations of consciousness, how we could work with memory, not from an omniscient point of view, but from being trapped in, or located at least in one moment in time, mm-hmm. looking backward, you know, those just moments of being, right, that she would get into. And, you know, in form, you're doing that, not only just the idea that, okay, it's a dinner party, here's one day, but it's also that mode of telling, of just slipping kind of seamlessly back into really foundational memories.
Well, I think, so I'm really interested in the architecture of memory in the book, and I'm really interested in the way there's something strange about how every day you're kind of making up your life story as you go along. So like yesterday, your life story was very different. It had a very different ending, you know, but then today it's like, no, these were the really important moments. That was actually the love of my life. I just didn't know, you know? And so like, that's, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about, you know, writing about it in a novel is that in a way, writing about memory in a novel can sometimes be approximate sort of like a truth more so than writing about it in a memoir, right? Because you're making it up. And if you just, you know, if you compare your memories with the memories of other people like you grew up with or you knew at the time, they'll say like, no, that's not really, you know, what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, would you, just to get everyone else kind of looped in, because I know the book just came out and we're not expecting that the audience has read it, will be kind of spoiler free, but would you read to us a bit, and then from there we'll have a bit more of a common sense of the book to go forward with?
Yeah. So you and I spoke a minute ago and I said I was going to read from the beginning, but then I had a little bit of a change of heart. And so I think I'm going to read a part where Lizette, so Lizelle is one of the protagonists of the book. And at this point, this memory that she's having, she meets up with her father, who she hasn't seen basically since she was three. And he left the family in Philadelphia and went off to California. And I think the only other thing you need to know here is that her mother's name is Verity. And Verity is a very strong character in the book. So this is her meeting up with her dad. Dark fell fast on the October afternoon when Lizelle found herself waiting in the bakery near the school where she worked. It was a warm, bright place where all the pastries tasted like sweet cardboard. She sipped coffee that she drank for courage, though she knew it would keep her up into the night, stewing over whatever happened here today. Despite the intervening years, her father was instantly recognizable from the sole photo of him that Verity had let her keep. Lizelle had studied the picture, As in the photo, the details of his appearance created a visual symphony called Well Cared For. It took a lot of up-close concentration to note the deep crease in his forehead and the fact that his hair was a shade too black, shoe polish-like. "I can't believe it," he said with a smile, his eyes growing dewy. One of the things she knew about him from Verity was that he liked to drive the car with the top down, even when it had been chilly. Long after he left, as they'd watched Waiting to Exhale, Verity had screamed, "Get the car!" at Angela Bassett as she destroyed her cheating husband's things. Without looking, Lizelle knew that the other women in the cafe were staring. She let herself be hugged, feeling smug and then foolish. Her father drank hot water, saying it was something he'd learned from his girlfriend of 3 years. Anne was Korean-American and only slightly older than Lizelle. "Wise for her age," he said. These were nervous digressions. He clearly hadn't meant to tell Lizelle that he was dating someone her age. Then he got to the point. What had finally, quote unquote, lit a fire under his ass to, quote unquote, reconnect with Lizelle was that Anne was pregnant and he needed to think seriously about family. Then he tried to explain why he'd disappeared all those years ago. "Look, Lizelle, I just got distracted." "Distracted," Lizelle repeated. She thought about an episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show she'd watched with Selena. There had been a long video montage buildup to a father-child reunion. Finally, the father was sitting next to his daughter on stage, her eyes glistening. He turned and faced her and Oprah, ready to explain what had happened. "Basically," he started, and Lizelle had started laughing. Neither she nor Selena heard the rest of what he said. After 15 years in the wind, this asshole began his answer with, "basically." Now her own father explained. "There were so many times I almost hopped on a flight here. Many times I picked up the phone to call. Once, Anne can confirm this, we were in D.C. and I went right up to the Amtrak kiosk. I was on a mission to get a ticket to Philly. That was 2 years ago. But the longer things went, it just went longer." "Your mother's daughter," he said with a little smile. "I know it doesn't sound right, but I'm just being honest. First, it was one thing, then another, then another. And then I convinced myself that you wouldn't see me or that Verity wouldn't let me see you. I just couldn't get my shit together. By the way, do you remember the Porsche?" She nodded. "I remember it as much as I remember you," she thought. "Maybe the Porsche is my real father. I was so unhappy here in Philly. Everything was so gray and sad and segregated. Things just didn't seem possible. And your mother would not even entertain the idea of a move out of West Philly, let alone anywhere new. You know how she just says no with her whole self? I know I shouldn't speak badly of her, and I'm not trying to. I can tell she was a great mom. So even though I loved you more than anything, I got it in my mind that if I could drive it out to the West Coast with the top off in the sun, then I would be happy." He emitted a harsh little laugh. "I grant you that I had kind of lost my mind." "Okay," Lizelle said. Lizelle was aware that her father, when he disappeared in a stupid car, had been about her age. The words he'd used, gray and sad and segregated, she felt them develop into a lump in her throat. She swallowed. "Did it work? Did you feel better when you got there?" "Well, the car died in Phoenix, near the desert. It's a beautiful piece of junk I had bought for my uncle when he went to prison. But your mother wired me the money to take a train to LA. And after a while, I did feel better, I guess. I broke into film doing sound, as you probably heard from your mom." She hadn't. "Well, have you ever seen the movie Cocktail?" She looked at him. "I missed you both. I truly did. But I knew I couldn't breathe here. And that if I stayed, we might all wind up on the news." Lizelle thought about that for a moment. "Can I ask, is all of this an elaborate way of telling me you're gay? Because, like, I don't care. I'm, Verity. I guess she told you that." He laughed. "That's fair. I was trying a lot of things out then. But I'm with Anne now. And frankly, sexuality was the least of it." "What was the most of it?" He laughed again. He laughed a lot. "Well, back when I was in Philly, I did sound work for concerts. So I was around a lot of musicians. They are surprisingly generous with their drugs. Luckily, I decided early on that wasn't my scene, but I'm not really gay. I mean, everybody's a little bit gay, right? He laughed. Before Lizelle could affirm that, he put down his mug and clapped. Okay, that's me for now, but I want to hear about you. Tell me everything, he said. Let's start today and move backward. Lizelle had an unpleasant sense of deja vu. She saw herself in Greenwich Village at a coffee shop, sitting across from a skinny, bug-eyed white woman who could not stop talking to her, her first internet date. In a sense, this was her second. She wondered what it would mean to have a father. And I will stop there.
Fantastic. I love that one of the things coming through there is the humor of the book, which it really is very funny. And it's not situational humor. It's not slapstick. It's not, you know, it's not ironic in tone, but there are just these moments of observational humor or dialogue-based humor that are part of, I think, the propulsive quality of the book. So I'm glad those came through. Yeah. So some of the things coming through, in that section that I think are foundational to the book. One is geography, that this really is a book about Philadelphia. Another was sexuality, which is key to the book in many ways. Less a part of that section, but certainly threaded throughout the book are questions of race, of interracial marriage, of race within politics. So those are elements that, are taking this. This is what makes it not, fan fiction or just participating in right the world that Virginia Woolf made, although I would say sexuality was something she was dealing with, even if obliquely, right? But she wasn't writing about Philadelphia. She wasn't writing about race. She wasn't writing about these particular issues. So I guess the way I'll ask this question is, if you had, if someone were teaching this book, for instance, alongside Mrs. Dalloway, or if a PhD student were reading this alongside Mrs. Dalloway and The Hours, for instance, what would you hope that people are able to see added, or added is the wrong word because it makes it sound, I take that back, because it makes it sound like we're adding to the original text, and this is not doing that. It's its own thing, it has its own gravity. But what connections and contrasts would you hope that people would see between the two, simply, if nothing else, in the elements that you are able to include, the themes and the, quite different in the elements that are weighing heavily on Virginia Woolf writing she was, right? Does that make sense? I'm sorry, I feel like
completely. Okay. So, I mean, one of the things I would say though is that, Mrs. Dalloway has these two characters. So it has Clarissa Dalloway, but then it also has Septimus Smith, who is a war veteran who's recovering. And so that's part of, like, I was sort of thinking about that juxtaposition, including Selena. So having Lizelle and Selena occupy the same space. And I think that, it's interesting to think about the way that different people experience the same traumatic world, right? And the way that certain people are closer to like the firing lines of the same traumatic world. And I think that, I really was trying to give the book a sense of, so I basically drafted this book like 2017, 2018. So it was like just after the 2016 presidential election, but before the era we know as now. And so it was like, I was sort of really interested in this idea of people feeling like, so sort of it takes place, but it takes place in like late second or like mid second Obama term. Right. And so I think there's still like an American sense of like, things might still really work out, kind of thing. But at the same time, like, just walking around the city, Philadelphia or whatever, there's clear signs of like the ravages of the opioid epidemic, but it's like right there. And then you can go to this restaurant, have a tasting menu, right? And so you're constantly, and so I think Mrs. Dalloway actually has a really good sense of that. Like, who gets burned and who is like sort of floating above it, but has an inkling of like, there's a world of pain out there kind of a thing. So that actually, in some ways, even though it definitely has different preoccupations, and Mrs. Dalloway certainly isn't concerned with like racial differences, you know, it is interested in class and privilege, right? And so I think like what this does is in sort of adapting that structure, and always, I'm always thinking about, I mean, Mrs. Dalloway is a modernist, but I'm always sort of thinking about the Victorians and how obsessed they were with like plotting out these grids of identity and hierarchies of identity. And so, you know, here I'm adding all of the, you know, a lot of the other different sort of like grid lines and these sort of hierarchies, and also these sort of questions about hierarchy and privilege and sort of interaction. And so, you know, I think it takes the sort of basic structure and these basic sort of, you know, comparisons and just sort of like proliferates them, right, in a way.
Yeah. That's interesting. This leads me kind of obliquely into another question, but the idea of all those, just that kind of hyper attention on the part of the Lizelle, which then of course is our attention as well, to power dynamics and who's sitting where and whose spouse stayed at home and who owes whom money and at this party. Which I loved. Here's the thing. Party scenes are so hard to read. Oh my God. My last novel, The Great Believers, started with a party scene, and at least I was able to get out of it. Like, I could just kind of be like, yeah, that's over. Okay, let's move on.
But you went back to it a lot of times. It was like actually really pivotal.
It's true. Right. Like it wasn't just a party. Like we go back to it. It like the difficulty of introducing that many characters at once, helping someone keep track of, you know, it's not like you're going, okay, here are two characters, let's get to know them for 25 pages and then we'll throw in a third. Right. This is everything happening. One thing I think you do very well there is signal to us who we need to really pay attention to.
Yeah,
and who
right.
we don't. Because it's right. not like give everyone something memorable, right. Charles Dickens style, and like, right. you know, it's more, this person got a paragraph of intro, so we probably want to track them. This person got a sentence of intro, so maybe not as much. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was in good hands there. But beyond that, I mean, because you're sustaining this party for a long time, and you have a lot of people, and it's a complicated, there are politics, there's money, there's family, there's history, there's race, there's, this is a very silly, simple question, but how did you do that?
I mean, the funny thing about, and so, I mean, just went over it and went over it and went over it and went over it. But I think that like, one of the things that's kind of funny about that is that it'd be so much easier to write like a 20-page story of somebody's life, and then you would get it all in there. It'd be so much easier than like writing these scenes where these people all have to speak in different voices and you have to know what they're doing. But I mean, really, I think of it a little bit like, it must be a little bit like acting. Like, I don't know if you find this when you're writing fiction where you're sort of reading things aloud and you're sort of like, oh, I'm in this and that's the only way I can hear this or think about this, you know? And so like just a lot of, it's one of those things in that I've written where I can just really see the room and just really see the people. I have to spend a lot of time doing that in order for it to work.
Do you have it mapped out on paper or visually? Is it all?
It's more visually. Like I can just, I can like see the light in the room and see, you know, and I also spend a lot of time, like there's two rooms and I was like, trying to suss those out, but it's more just like I can sort of imagine what it looks like there and the way certain things are arranged in a way that is not necessarily the case with, you know, a lot of other things that I've written. But I think the other thing is like I spent, you know, both my first two books are basically about like seventh grade dances. And so I've actually written, a lot of party scenes. And so this, not, you know, but party scenes, not where you have so many people making dinner conversation or whatever, because seventh graders, but still like that. That's, you know, it's almost like, you know, if you were a kind of person who was talented at writing war scenes, like there's a certain kind of choreography in there. So you put these people here, do this. So it, I think it must be also partly that because of my experience writing these like party scenes or these dance scenes that I was able to do this.
That makes sense, right? It's crowd management for our imaginary friends.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I have not, what I haven't done since I read this is go back to Mrs. Dalloway, which it's been maybe 20 years here, and see if there are direct correlations between some of the minor characters and some of the minor characters in Mrs. Dalloway. Would I find pretty tight correlations there?
Or? Not at all. So, no? I mean, the main thing is like, you know, a woman sort of at middle age or middle life, like looking back on her life and, you know, a feeling of regret. And then across town, somebody who, you know, so in Mrs. Dalloway, they're not really connected. You know, they sort of, the two characters meet very briefly, but like this is kind of like these two characters are you know, connected. And then I took the last line of Mrs. Dalloway. It is the last line of this book, basically. So
wait a second.
So I did that, but none of the, but the other, it is mainly about the structure and the sense of contrasting these two characters who are having a very different day.
Yeah.
And experience of the world.
And that really, and we should talk about Selena a little bit, who I mean, I think is just such a it's interesting because we start with Lizelle so strongly that she always feels like our anchor in this world, right? It's not like two pages from her, two pages from Selena,
and
we really are anchored in this one scene. And Selena, there's we go really deep on her when we are with her and into childhood trauma and dreams she had, but she's. The way you've situated her within the book, it's, you know, we get more of her in the second half. Mm-hmm. And we first really see her through Lizelle's eyes. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of, she's fundamentally the secondary, mm-hmm. the satellite to this planet. Mm-hmm. Was your choice in doing that? Did that have to do with the wolf, or did that have to do also with, you know, with your intentions? And I'm wondering, you know, taking the person who's kind of more traumatized, more sensitive, more absorbent to the world, and putting her in some ways on the narrative periphery. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, what effect does that have in the way we see her? Does it give us sort of a respite from her? Would it be, I think it would be too much to have Selena at the center of the book. She's almost too much to handle. Sometimes, I don't know. What was your thinking there?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was more, it was like how craft was going. I mean, I think originally, it's not that there were, the novel wasn't necessarily more balanced in terms of, how much time they took up, but I sort of had some of those sections with Selena earlier and like working with the editor, I sort of divided them up. But one thing I would say is that I think like the person who shifts the trajectory of things is Lizelle when she makes a phone call to Selena, right? And so in a sense, like that's part of why it's sort of, you know, shift, it's sort of like structured that way. Like, you know, I think she's the one who's sort of calling Selena back into whatever this is. And the occasion for the book is basically her reminiscence, you know, her reminiscing about them. And so it kind of, I think that was part of it. And I think that she's also the anchor because the day that she's having and the front story is sort of like what sets all this into motion in a way as well, right? I mean, I think certainly you could write a novel that was more heavily from Selena's perspective, and there are certainly novels like that, but it would be a very different kind of experience, you know? And yeah. I also do like to think that, I mean, I think Selena's sections are definitely much more melancholy, right? And upsetting and tragic. But I do think that there is a thread of humor that runs through her as well. Like there's a kind of wry humor that runs through her section. She's also somebody who's just kind of like watching people make fools of themselves, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. She's got that amazing line. And I think it's maybe through Lizelle's memory, but her saying like, you know, she's very upset about, you know, talking about how she, as a young child, she was very upset about the treatment of Native Americans. And Lizelle saying, well, why, you know, but we're here and it's okay. And this isn't happening to you. And her saying, well, if it's happened to anyone, it's like it happened to me. And I just butchered that. It's much better the way you heard it.
That's basically the upshot of it.
The gist of it, right? With better wording. There's something just so raw, I think, about her. And I think maybe what I was trying to say or ask before was, I think, yeah, you could have centered her.
Yeah.
There's something about her being on the periphery that's almost like she's so raw that we can't, that it's like we can't spend too much time looking right at her. We gotta pull back. That actually, I think, heightens that rawness, if that makes sense.
Well, I think also, I mean, like looking at things and pulling back, I think is like really a lot of how we spend our time as a society. And so, you know, I mean, I think, and Lizelle is a kind of extreme example of that, because I think my idea about her is that she's somebody who's structured her entire life as armor against the things that could possibly hurt her and make her vulnerable.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, it's interesting to just like look at that. You know, look at how, you know, she manages that. And also the fact that in order to authentically, when you're somebody who authentically experiences the suffering of other people in a way that is actually in proportion with their suffering, then you're insane, right? Like, you know, so I think like the sort of like what sanity, you know, what we think of sanity is somebody who can like look at all sorts of things and just say, well, it's, you know, it's okay. It's not happening to me, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, so that was something I was also interested in.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's so hard to get us to really understand equally two dramatically different characters and not take sides, mm-hmm. not feel like, you know, like, well, this is my favorite one. You know, I think that happens so often with it. Maybe it's two time periods, it's two modes of telling, it's two characters.
Yeah.
Kind of declare their allegiance to one or the other and then be like, mm-hmm. I'm going to skim this. It's not as good as my favorite. Mm-hmm. And I never felt like that here. I felt like, you know, when we do shift over, maybe because of Lizelle's interest in Selena, it feels like this is something I really need to know. Mm-hmm. I do like Lizelle, and I've been at her party and I see her flaws, but I really like her, but I'm happy to be over here. And then I'm happy to swing back, which the pacing and timeline that I know it's tricky. That does not come.
Well, that was like a lot of the work of it. And also I think what I tried to do in those sections was have, you know, write things that were really different kind of scenarios and different kinds of complementary people. So like you have Verity, but then you have Selena's mom and you have Selena's father and their house. And so it's so like they're in such a sharp contrast, which is something that actually I thought a lot about with regard to Sula, right? One of the things about Sula is that Sula and Nell come from these very different households and they both are sort of covetous of each other's households. And so, you know, just thinking about what, you know, how they've set their lives up, it's like a, you know, it's a very different kind of pageant when they're sort of doing This Is Your Life. And so that's also another way to get you interested in two distinct characters, to have them not echo each other too much.
Right. Because it's not as if we're just in the echo chamber of one person's mind. Right. It's different casts, different settings, different, it's like the the scenery is swept away and we have a whole new
day
going on. Yeah. So I can't resist, because you have, Lizelle loves to ask sort of table questions at her parties. And the question, I'm sure everyone who interviews you is doing this, but I don't care.
No, not yet.
So one of the questions she asks the table full of people is, what's your biggest irrational fear, in slightly different words? So I have to ask you the same question.
What is my biggest irrational fear? Funnily enough, I'm not ready to answer this question. This is not an original one, but I think certainly, like, when I moved to this house and I was with a friend of mine who I think may be out there in Zoom land, and I saw a mouse come out from under the stove, and my first thought was literally like, we should burn down the house.
Yeah, that would be my thought. I would have helped you.
But it's funny because you feel like it's that irrational because so many people share it, but it really, my thought was like, yeah, we should burn down the house.
I feel like my ancestors survived the plague by avoiding rodents.
That's probably true.
So my biggest irrational one is when you go to the bathroom on an airplane and you push the flush button, I always think I'm going to get sucked out of the airplane into the vortex and it's going to fall out of the plane.
But it hasn't happened yet.
Right? Not yet. No, and I'm good. I don't like leave without flushing because that would be obnoxious, but every time I'm like, I'm going to die.
That's so far, so good. Yeah. That's a pretty good one, but I can imagine really hard to shake.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds. It's the sound. It's that there's silence, and then a moment later, it's like just all around you. Yeah, it's not good. But I love that part of the party dynamic, honestly, in the book that you have these moments of kind of, I guess, what might seem at least like frivolity. You allow those moments where it's not like directly moving the plot forward. But of course, this novel is so tightly edited that you're doing many, many things under the surface with power relations and everything as this is going on. But when you read, you can just kind of relax into this, like, I mean, maybe it's that I miss dinner parties so much. I would play them there. It's great. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also just, you know, I really do think that books should be entertaining. I mean, I think like that's no matter what you're doing, and it doesn't always have to be funny, you know, in that way, but like in terms of being engaging, I think, you know, I'm really big into dialogue and really big into like having people be themselves in that way, because I think that's one of the things that, you know, that makes people bearable or interesting at all, right? Is like this kind of, like these kinds of conversations that they have, and these kind of moments that are like character moments, right? Like you see who they are in these really quick moments.
Yeah, I think it's very easy for me to tell. There are authors who I think are far too comfortable with boring us, just feeling, you know, to put it bluntly, that kind of like, well, I'm, you know, you have to focus your attention on what I'm saying. It's very important. And okay. I live in fear of boring people. I feel like this is, it is literature, but it is also entertainment. And if we were around a fire 1,000, 2,000 years ago, and you don't tell a good story, you're out of job. Like, you're gonna run you out of town, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I really do feel strongly about that, and I think that, you know, I mean, this is very the novel's short, so I'm really, yes, you know, I really try to make it concentrated in terms of like an experience in a lot of ways.
I'm struggling with that right now, editing my next one. It's very long, and I'm kind of doing this accordion thing with adding and subtracting, and I'm looking at this, like, it's under 200 pages. It just sails along so tightly, and I'm envious. I'm hoping I can suck some of that energy, learn from it.
I want to thank both of you for this fantastic conversation tonight. We've all really enjoyed it, and thank you both for taking the time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from journalist Tom Rostin about his new book, The Writer's Crusade, Kurt Vonnegut and the Many Lives of Slaughterhouse-Five. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.